The following is a presentation of the Dirt Track Channel.
Well, hi there, everybody. I'm Sean Wood, and welcome to the Sprint Car Show for Tuesday, January the 7th. On today's broadcast, we'll talk with longtime public relations director Bob Miller with the United Racing Company as they get set to celebrate their 67th season this year. And we'll talk with Steve Beitler, who is now the new promoter of the Grays Harbor Raceway. That's all coming up next here on the Sprint Car Show, brought to you by Coastal 181. Coastal 181, reading for racers, and by Penske Racing Shocks, the competitive advantage of champions, and by the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum, located outside of Turn 2 at the famed Knoxville Raceway.
The National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum in Knoxville, Iowa, is the only sprint car museum in the world dedicated to promoting the future of sprint car racing and preserving the past. Located in Turn 2 of the world-famous Knoxville Raceway, the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum is open 7 days a week, year-round, except New Year's Day, Easter, Thanksgiving Day, and Christmas Day. Non-wing sprint cars, historic big cars, open-wheel roadsters, and wing sprinters are all on display in the museum, which also features a movie theater and the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame. Make plans now to stop by the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum the next time you're in Knoxville, Iowa, or shop our museum store online at www.sprintcarstuff.com. The Hall of Fame and Museum is open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Central Time, Monday through Friday, and from noon to 5 p.m. Central Time on Saturdays and Sundays.
Hi, this is Bad Chad Layton. You're listening to the Sprint Car Show with Sean Wood.
And welcome back to the Sprint Car Show here on the DirtTrackChannel.com as we kick off the 2014 season with one of the oldest, and actually it is the oldest, touring sprint car series in the country, having begun in 1947. They'll have their 67th season of competitive sprint car racing coming up this year. We're pleased to be joined now by the longtime public relations director for the United Racing Company and a longtime good friend, Mr. Bob Miller. Bob, happy New Year to you, and welcome back to the show once again.
Well, happy New Year, Sean, and thanks as always for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
67 years, Bob. That's quite a long time. There has been some tremendous names that have come through the ranks of URC. What's been the secret to the success of URC for its longevity?
Well, I really think having a division that we've tried to keep affordable, scheduling events at tracks that the drivers and owners wanted to compete, and being somewhat open to taking in suggestions and recommendations from the teams on the things that they'd like to see. And I think as we look into 2014, we've listened a lot to our competitors, through the second half of the season and much even into the winter months. We met with a lot of the car owners and drivers, and we just thought it was time to kind of turn a new leaf with URC and come out with this new deal and a come one, come all. I think over the years, it might have been perceived that URC being a club from its original start and then transitioning into a business, that maybe we were a little bit more closed-minded. And what we're trying to sell in 2014 is that it is a new URC. We've updated things like our handicapping and some of the things that we do on a night-to-night basis to kind of bring it up to speed with how the rest of the racetracks and other traveling sprint car organizations operate. So hopefully that's an open and welcome change that'll bring in some new drivers to experience the good purse, the solid point fund that we've had. And one of the things that we're really proud of is what we do around a checking perspective and how we handle race night, race calls and officiating.
Let's delve into this a little bit, Bob. I just picked out a couple of things that I thought jumped out. How do you think, just from the standpoint of the open draw, the redraw for the features will attract, say, a new person that wants to come and run with URC?
Well, in the old world, Sean, we lined up our heat races based off of points and then lined our feature up based off of heat race finishes, driven by where they started in their point standing. So for a driver coming, from another racetrack or organization to come in one night with us, you know, they'd be, you know, starting at the rear of the heat and be somewhat penalized in the feature lineup handicapping as well. So we're hoping by taking that out and making it an open draw, you know, that drivers will give it a shot. You know, whether it's a 358 driver in central Pennsylvania who might want to come to a track like Big Diamond or Grandview or even Bedford, you know, or a 305 driver that may want to come, you know, to a track close to him. You know, it gives them that opportunity of, I'm going to come through the gate and draw, and that'll be my luck of the draw and where I start, versus knowing right out of the gate they're coming in to start, you know, at the back of the pack. You know, the other thing I think with URC is, you know, there was a perception, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but sometimes, you know, perceptions are harder to change than reality. But I think people thought that because it was a closed organization or in years past a club, you know, that outsiders weren't welcome. And I think that's the furthest from the truth. I think if you talk to drivers like Mark Smith or Pat Cannon, Blaine Heimbach, you know, Lance DeWeese, you know, guys who have come and run with us occasionally, I think they would tell you that we're about as fair as the day is long. But there's still perceptions out there. So I think the draw will help bring people in so they get an opportunity to see how fair we run our races, and yet we do enforce our rules. So hopefully that's the incentive to bring, you know, some new drivers and owners into URC.
Bob, what was the reaction from the drivers and the car owners about eliminating the handicapping penalty?
I really think most people liked it. Now, the drivers, you know, that are on the top end, you know, the drivers that are coming in to win and chase the title, you know, they like it from the idea that, you know, they're not going to be penalized starting in the rear week after week. You know, but URC has changed. You know, if we look 15 to 20 years ago, we had 15 to 18 drivers or owners, 15 to 18 race teams that made every race. Last year, I think we had 6 or maybe 7. You know, the cost of racing today is far higher than it was, you know, in URC's early years. And, you know, we have teams that just can't make every race. And then when they fall out of the inversion, you know, they're coming in, then being penalized to start in the rear. And, you know, we need these drivers. You know, if somebody can run 10 races with us, that's great. And we need them for those 10 shows. So we need to make it accommodating for the little guy who might not be able to run our entire schedule, but still feels he has a shot of a good starting spot by the luck of the draw. So I think overall, whether you're looking at the top-end drivers or the middle of the pack or, you know, the back of the field, you know, the guys feel that the handicapping going to an open draw, you know, really helps them all around.
Also notice that part of this new deal was you're incorporating the 305 sprint car rules. Can you explain that aspect of the new come one, come all concept?
Yeah, that got a little bit more negative reaction than I really wanted it to. Again, there's no goal here that URC is looking to become a 305 organization. That's not what we're all about. But much like the World Without Laws or many of the other traveling organizations or even the weekly sprint car tracks have allowed 305s to come and run with us. Now, I think the truth is, you know, most of us all know it's going to be tough for a 305 to be competitive. So the reality is we're not seeing this just to become a shift where we get 10 or 15 305s to compete with URC. But again, what it comes back to, if we have an event on a local track where there are 305s in the area, it gives them an opportunity to come and see our payoff, you know, from our $2,000 to win to our $400 for 10th to our $250 to take the green. It sees our special event payoff. It sees how we handicap, you know, how we officiate, you know, how we do our payoff. You know, it shows them, you know, what URC is all about. But I don't see it being a transition where 305s are going to come in and run with URC every week. But it is an opportunity for car owners and drivers to take a shot once, twice, three times a year and say they like it, that maybe next year they make that next level move to go 360 sprint car racing. That is the goal behind opening the door for 305s to compete.
Is there a concern, Bob, among the 360 organizations out there that the 305s might be a way for a guy to go out and have fun at a less expensive if that is such a word in our industry today, is there a concern about the growing number of 305 sprint cars even though what you just said is you're giving them the opportunity to see what could happen if a 305 driver decides to move up in the world of sprint car racing?
Well, you know, I've never been concerned about the 305 division, hurting URC from that perspective. I think it is, you know, we've talked about this for several years. You know, my partners at URC and I, you know, we really should have been ahead of this and started our own 305 URC class as a feeder. Mm-hmm. So we did miss the boat on that. We were going really strong with a nice schedule, you know, a $50,000+ point fund, great car counts, and we just didn't see at the time that we should have done it. You know, now looking back, we probably should have. But for now, what we'll do is just hopefully offer the very next step up for these drivers to, you know, move on and advance in their career, and hopefully we see those drivers at some point leave URC to go on to, you know, the 410 sprints of Pennsylvania or even the World of Outlaws. You know, that's how we look at it. So I think the 305s, have a place. You know, my biggest advice would be, you know, they need to do whatever they can to retain the cost and not let that division escalate in cost as well. But, you know, time will tell, but I look at the 305s and down the road we'll see more of those guys coming to URC and hopefully moving on in the whole food chain of sprint car racing.
And the one last thing I want to talk to you about here on this new deal for URC in 2014 is the new tire size from American Racer. Can you tell us what it is?
I don't have it in front of me, so I apologize. But you know, basically we've stayed with the American Racer tire. It's been a great tire for URC. Very affordable as well. You know, it's far cheaper than other tires that are out there. And, you know, we've looked at how can we help maintain the cost, you know, sprint car racing. And again, what we've elected to do is, you know, trim back our point fund a little bit by lowering the price of the tires. You know, our goal really is we need to get these guys money, you know, while they're in the midst of their racing season versus holding it all till the end of the year at the banquet. So, I think the American Racer is a very good tire, and we've stood by this tire, you know, for, you know, probably close to 15 years now.
Last year, J.J. Grosso was a champion, but unfortunately the season was overshadowed by the tragic death of Kramer Williamson in August and the tragic passing of longtime URC competitor and tech guy Mitch Miller. Two true class act gentlemen, two true class act champions in their own rights. Talk a little bit about both of those guys, what they meant to URC, and any outlook for something to do in terms of remembering both of them with either a memorial race or some kind of award as the years go forward.
Well, you know, needless to say, it was a tough year for URC. You know, losing Midge, who not only was just a stout and reliable competitor with URC, I mean, his credibility just grew even more when he took on the role as our tech man and really helped turn the corner with URC around getting even a stronger handle on teching. And, you know, we had some hard times through all that, but, you know, Midge helped us through his mannerism and how he dealt with car owners and drivers in teching was just phenomenal. He just had a way of delivering the message and helping people through, you know, whatever the situation might have been on race night. So, you know, for Midge, you know, what a loss for racing, but especially for URC and what he did from a teching perspective and credibility for the organization. Now, you know, when you go over and talk about Kramer, I mean, again, just another legend and somebody who, you know, I just had a great relationship with and had so much fun. You know, it's just hard to believe. It's probably the most shocking, thing that I've had to experience in racing. And of course, being there that night at Lincoln and, you know, just hoping that you'd see him jump out of the car and everything would be okay. But, you know, it wasn't too many minutes into that accident that we knew it was a severe problem. And, you know, it was just a tragic night. But, you know, I do know at Students Grove they're going to be doing something with Kramer, rolling out what's going to be called the Kramer Cup, and I think it's a pink trophy that will go to the race winner, but then it'll also be a perpetual traveling trophy that'll remain at the racetrack. And every year the winner's name gets added. So a great way to honor Kramer. And I'm looking to do something for Midge as well at one of NBU or the Lincoln URC show that's going to double up the night USAC is there.
You have great memories of both Midge Miller and Kramer Williamson to carry on, and I'm sure they're going to be very happy with whatever is done in the future to remember these two great champions. We have a lot more to talk with about auto racing and sprint cars in specific with Bob Miller. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk some non-wing sprint car racing plus the 25th anniversary of Thunder on the Hill. We'll take a short break and be back with more right after this. Just in time for spring, motorsports publisher Coastal 181 will deliver another great open-wheel book titled The People's Champ, A Racing Life. This autobiography of USAC Triple Crown champion Dave Darlin looks at his racing career from quarter midgets to sprint cars. The People's Champ is sure to be a hit with open-wheel fans about one of the sport's true class acts. To learn more, visit Coastal181.com or call them toll-free at 877-907-8181. Coastal 181, reading for racers.
Hi, this is Greg Hodnett. You're listening to the Sprint Car Show with Sean Wood.
And back here on the Sprint Car Show, we continue our conversation with Bob Miller, the longtime public relations director, and now one of the three people in charge of the United Racing Company, along with John and Cher Zimmerman. We're going to talk a little non-wing sprint car racing, as Bob was very instrumental in helping to bring the back-in-the-day SCRA non-wing sprint cars all the way from the Phoenix, Arizona-based area to Central PA. And now for the eighth year, it's the Eastern Storm. The United States Auto Club sprint cars will be coming in to Central Pennsylvania for their annual Eastern Storm. That will get up underway on June the 3rd at the Jesse Hockett Classic, which if you have not seen the non-wing boys at Grandview, if you haven't seen the sprint car show at Grandview, you owe it to yourself to get there and check out either a Thunder on the Hill or an Eastern Storm event, because it's pretty amazing what these cars can do on a high-banked third-mile track. So, Bob, June 3rd, Grandview, ARDC, USAC, always a great, great night. What's the anticipation like for this year's USAC Eastern Storm?
Hey, all we need to say is the modern-day cowboy. I mean, if that guy didn't put on a show last year, you know, I have never seen anything like the show he put on last year. That was just phenomenal. And you know, he is going to run the entire USAC tour this year. So you know, Pennsylvania fans, get ready. Darren Clayton's coming east.
And he better be bringing an extra truckload of T-shirts, because I remember the first time he came in here, he sold out T-shirts before the tour was over. Al, you mentioned briefly in our last segment when we were talking about URC, Lincoln Speedway, and I see that Lincoln is back on the schedule. Tell us a little bit about this entire Eastern Storm and what's on tap for the fans to see in the first week of June.
All right, well, June 3rd, as you said, USAC will come east. The opening Eastern Storm will take place at Grandview on Tuesday night, June 3rd. The following night, June 4th, we'll be out at Lincoln Speedway. And at Lincoln, we'll actually have URC on that show. So, you know, what you'll see is a wing and non-wing doubleheader at Lincoln Speedway on June 4th. On June 5th, USAC will move to the New Egypt Speedway, and they'll be joined there by the ARDC non-wing midget. They're going to take Friday night off, although there's some discussions of some other things perhaps in the works. Not quite ready to announce that yet, but we're working on something for Friday night. Then on June 7th, Saturday night, we'll be at the Always Fast Port Royal Speedway. Then close out the series at Todd Fisher's Susquehanna Speedway on June 8th. So, you know, a great week of racing, especially for non-wing fans.
Speaking of New Egypt Speedway, before I forget, the last couple of years, you and Lenny Sammons, the proprietor of Area Auto Racing News, have put together the Jersey Rush. Will that be back for 2014?
Absolutely. Coming back again in a double show with the Modifies, and that'll take place again in August. So, looking forward to that one. I mean, just a great facility. And, you know, with the awesome track conditions there, I mean, the 410s are just terrific. And, well, what can you say about USAC? You know, you get those non-wing boys out there, they can put on a show.
And I was just looking back. I found a picture, and I'll have to get it off to you. I found a picture that somebody took of me doing an interview with Billy Pouch Sr. Back in the early days of Thunder on the Hill. 25 years already, Bob, for this great little show that you have within the year, May 25th. Features only, 7 features. It kicks off the 25th anniversary of Thunder on the Hill. As you look back, did you think you were going to get past show number one?
Show number one was a real that was a real hurdle, because I've never done anything like this before. And it's amazing. As a race fan growing up, you know, you can say, well, this is what they should do at this track, and this is what they should do at that track. And I'm sure you've heard it, and you go on the Internet, everybody's got the answer for what racetracks need to do. And then, you know, you realize, you know, 2 days before this show, you're now the one who has to make this all happen. And, you know, we were confronted with a very, very bad forecast, 80% chance of rain, you know, 2 days before this event. You know, it was just unbelievable. Then at 2 o'clock that afternoon, the weather moved out, the sun came out. It was a gorgeous night. I think we had maybe 40 some sprint cars in the pit area. Back then, you only needed one division, so it was a great night. And Steve Smith came home the winner of the very first. Actually, he won the first 2 Thunder on the Hill shows, and here we are, 25 years later, and 109 Thunder on the Hill events in the books. But yeah, there's been a lot of stress, obviously, over the years. I mean, the weather is always the biggest issue. But the fun part is when we did things like bring CRA in, and flying out and, meeting Jack Hewitt at Manzanita and making sure that we had all these guys, engaged to come east. And, that didn't work out for too long. Maybe we did CRA 2 years. Then I worked with Ronnie Schumann to bring SCRA in, and I think we did that for a year or two, and we just couldn't get it to stick. But, 7-plus years ago, we connected with USAC, put together this Eastern Storm, and, it's just been growing ever since. So, I mean, that was obviously a fun thing, working to bring the World of Outlaws to Grandview, dirt-modified shows, mixing all these events up with different divisions. And May 25th, we'll open our 25th season with the Lucky 7, and that'll be a 7 features program, no heat races or qualifying. Two URC sprint features, 2 modified features, and then the Legends, ARDC, and the Sportsman will all go with the 25-lap feature. So that's how we're going to open the season, and then we'll come back on June 3rd. With USAC on Tuesday, July 1st, Pennsylvania Sprint Speed Week, 410 Sprint, and the ROC Modifieds will double up. And then we'll bring that show back on Tuesday, July 29th, 410 Sprints, and this time the 17th annual traffic jam for the Modifieds. And then we'll close out the Thunder season on Saturday, October 18th, again with the House of Thunder Halloween Party and the Grandview Thunder 525.
Well, always an exciting schedule for the Thunder on the Hill. I'm still scratching my head and going back and remembering interviewing Mark Kinzer at the top of the hill there during the Outlaw show that 1 year when I was a pit reporter in the early days of Thunder on the Hill. Hard to believe 25 years already. Time does fly when you're having fun in this business, does it not, Bob?
It sure does. And I have that picture of you and Mark doing that interview. That in my... There's just so many great memories. When we had Chris Economac, he came in for a couple of the shows. I mean, that's always nice. And, when we had our 100th Thunder on the Hill event, we had a lot of friends came out. Jay James, who at the time was, running Bridgeport Speedway, and, the relationship that we've had with people from, New Egypt and some folks from Dirt. And, it was just nice to have a lot of people come out to celebrate the 100th race. And, now here we are in our 25th season. So, and a lot of the credit really does go to the racetrack. I mean, Grandview Speedway is just a phenomenal facility to watch racing. And, the Rogers family, they always provide a good racetrack. And I'll tell you, you drop the green flag on the 410 sprints or, the modifieds or USAC or whoever, and, you're going to be holding on to your seat because it's going going to get real interesting.
As I said before, folks, if you have not seen a 410 winged or non-winged sprint car show at Grandview with the Thunder on the Hill with the USAC Eastern Storm, you owe it to yourself. And even on Saturday nights, boy, you talk about some great modified battles over the years with some of the top named drivers in the sports in the 358 division. You definitely want to check out Grandview Speedway. Well, Bob, as always, we thank you for your time. Greatly appreciate it. And we wish all the best of luck, not only with the Eastern Storm and Thunder on the Hill, but with URC this year.
Well, thank you, Sean. And again, I appreciate what you and all the other media members do for short track racing. You know, it's become very competitive, and everybody's out there for the advertising dollar. You know, you've got NASCAR, you know, everywhere you turn around, there's something going on with NASCAR. So it's very competitive. So any media coverage or exposure we can get, I greatly appreciate what you and all your friends in the media do for short track racing, and greatly appreciate the drivers and owners who field these cars, put in countless hours working on them, and the fans who support the show. So thanks to everybody.
Bob Miller from the United Racing Company joining us here on the Sprint Car Show. We will take a break and be back with more right after this.
The world leader in suspension technology, Penske Racing Shocks has been providing custom-built, high-performance shock absorbers to all forms of racing for over 20 years. Offering only the highest quality suspension products, shocks are available in non, single, double, triple, and four-way adjustable configurations. All Penske Racing Shocks are hand-built, tailored to meet a driver's feel or car setup, and dyno-tested, ensuring the highest attention is paid to detail, consistency, and performance. For your short track needs, contact Dave Reedy at Penske Shocks at 610-375-6180. That's 610-375-6180. Penske Racing Shocks are available direct from the manufacturer or through many dealers worldwide. Visit them on the web at www.penskeshocks.com. Penske Racing Shocks, the competitive advantage of champions.
Hi, this is Greg Hodnett. You're listening to the Sprint Car Show with Sean Wood.
And welcome back to the Sprint Car Show here on the DirtTrackChannel.com. We head out to the Pacific Northwest, where we're joined by former World of Outlaw racer and longtime owner of the Skagit Speedway, Steve Beitler. And Steve's here to talk to us about the new partnership that they have in helping to get Grays Harbor Raceway up and running to the level that Skagit is at the present time. Steve, pleasure to talk with you, and welcome to the Sprint Car Show.
Well, thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be on here, and you know, I'm out here in the beautiful state of Washington, and just so you know, it's actually pronounced Skagit, the racetrack out here. It's a soft G, but it's a common mistake made by a lot of people. It looks like Skagit, but it's actually pronounced Skagit. So.
All right, we will remember that, and we appreciate you letting us know about that, because we want to try to promote everything properly. Grays Harbor, not that, down the road from you, and you've been at Skagit since 01. So what brought about the opportunity to take over Grays Harbor, and how's that going to benefit the racers out west with you having now the two racetracks?
Well, it's going to be a real win-win for everybody, the racers, the fans, the sponsors, pretty much everybody. There's two main tracks in Western Washington, and it's really about the only two dirt tracks that's run on a regular basis the entire state, and that's Skagit Speedway and Grays Harbor Raceway. And, back in the middle 90s when I was racing for World of Outlaws, Fred Brownfield, his lease Skagit, went down and took over the lease at Grays Harbor and rebuilt the facility and really did a nice job with it. And then, unfortunately, Fred was killed in an accident, and it's changed hands. They went to another operating management company, and they've changed promoters there a few times, and they really just struggled with it. And, so we have an opportunity. Their contract was terminated early, and I was approached and asked if I'd be interested in taking a look at it, which I was. So we took a look at it, and it's a pretty nice facility. It just needs a little TLC, and, it just needs to be remarketed, rebranded, and so we put together a pretty strong package and presented to the fair board and the commissioners, and down the final two, and did oral interviews. And, then 2 days later, they awarded us the contract. And so we're just kind of hitting the ground running, and a little bit late in the game to be kicking off the race season. But, you know, a lot of work to do, but I got a good team, so we're all working hard on it.
Can you tell us what are the similarities, if any, between the two tracks, and do you think you're going to be able to draw the same types of crowds at both race facilities?
Well, I mean, about the biggest similarities are both dirt ovals. That's really, really it. Skagit's a little smaller, higher banked, more of a bowl. Gray's Harbor, you know, it'd be kind of like Eldora, it'd be like Skagit, higher bank, a little smaller bowl. And then Gray's Harbor would be shaped a little more like, you know, like, you know, not quite, kind of like Williams Grove in a set, or Port Royal, you know. It's a little bit longer straightaways, tighter corners, a little flatter, and, you know, it's a pretty racy joint. But, you know, as far as the crowd, you know, they're about 155 miles apart, and you've got Seattle, Tacoma, Everett. There's huge metropolis in between them, and both of them are just about 60 miles from downtown Seattle. So you basically, Seattle North is, we focus on Skagit Speedway, and then Seattle South, we're going to focus on the Gray's Harbor Raceway. So it's really, for the weekly shows, it's two completely different race crowds that come to the races. But obviously on the big shows, when the Outlaws are up here and then down there, and some of our big, the local and regional events, we'll have fans go back and forth. And with having both racetracks under one umbrella, it's going to allow us to do the scheduling, so we're not scheduled on top of each other. That's happened so much in the past. And, you know, when you got a good group of racers down at Gray's Harbor, the fans from up here can go down there, and Dirt Cup and stuff here at Skagit, you know, the fans from the Gray's Harbor area can come up here and watch it. So the fans are going to get to see a lot more racing, I think a lot more quality racing, and the racers are going to be able to race, you know, for more money, because there'll be some other large shows down there and up here as well that won't conflict with each other. And I think it's going to build a pretty good following back and forth.
Steve, without getting into any of the legal aspects, can you tell us as to what the term is in terms of how many years you will have the lease for, and what type of improvements are you looking to make at Gray's Harbor that the fans will notice when they come in for the season opener?
Well, right now, under the terms of the bid process, they're only offering a three-year term, but that's negotiable. We're going to hopefully, I'm going to present a finalized contract to them middle of this week. That's going to, you know, it's like anything, there's going to be a few things I want to see changed, and some of the wording, and obviously the length of the contract. You know, it's impossible to come into any kind of a facility and invest the money in track equipment and concession equipment and just all the marketing and the startup costs and only have it for 3 years. So, you know, I'm obviously going to go for a longer term contract, whether it be a single entity contract or one that's got some renewable phases to it. So we'll get that kicked off, and then the contract is pretty solid the way it's written. And as far as the facility, you know, they completely rebuilt that racetrack. The county put probably $400,000 in the track, and then the Brownfield, he put a lot of money into the pit area and the actual racing surface and lights and stuff himself. So there is probably a $700,000 or $800,000 rebuild done on the track down there about 8 or 9 years ago. So the track itself, the facility is really nice. It just needs a little TLC. You know, the fences need to be painted, and the pit area needs to be re-graveled and regraded. But, you know, as far as where the fans are and stuff, it's pretty nice. You know, you just power wash some stuff and clean it up a little bit and, you know, spruce it up a little bit. It's really ready to go.
Do you have a tentative opening day set for both Gray's Harbor and Skagit this year?
Skagit always kicks off play day the first weekend in April. So the first 2 weeks in April, we'll practice up here, and then we'll start racing up here the third weekend in April. And as far as Gray's Harbor, I don't have an exact opening date yet. It typically starts about the middle of April down there. But, you know, I know we're going to have to push it back a couple of days, because the county's still in some litigation with the former lessees over some equipment and things like that down there. And, you know, I'm letting them get that all sorted out before we can actually take possession of the racetrack. So right now we're just working on all the business part of it, get all our, you know, everything from banking accounts and telephones and P.O. boxes set up, and, you know, of course, getting the scheduling done, the marketing and meeting with sponsors, and, you know, joining the Chamber of Commerce and just getting embedded in the community. So there's a lot of work that's got to go on before we even worry about working at the track. So that'll give them time to get all the issues resolved with the former lessees. So to answer your question, you know, we're probably going to have to back it up a couple, 3 weeks to somewhere on the first part of May of this year, and gives me time to get whatever new equipment we're going to have to move in there, get it moved in and get the rest of the staff put together. And I was fortunate I was able to retain, you know, four or five of the key people down there that really want to be involved. So it's just a matter of filling the rest of the holes and then getting some training and kind of getting them onto the business plan that we use up here that's worked so well for us.
It's great to hear promoters say get involved not only in the community but also the Chamber of Commerce. And I think as I've traveled throughout this great country of ours and the years I've spent covering our beloved sport, over the years, I think, Steve, we've lost that aspect with a lot of the promoters where they've thrown open the doors and said, oh, just come on in because you have a worldwide and well-known name. But that's not the case these days because back when I started covering motorsports in 86, we didn't have Facebook, there was no social media, and we didn't have a hashtag. You know, times have changed so much. So what have you guys been able to do to keep your success rate as high as it has been outside of the local community and Chamber of Commerce involvement? And you're also the first track to jump on board with legendary promoter H.A. Humpy Wheeler Speedway Benefits. What do you think that's going to bring to the world of grassroots racing?
We all know Humpy Wheeler doesn't touch nothing without it being successful one way or another. I mean, him and Tripp and Clint and all the guys that are involved in that deal, they've invested a lot of their own personal money. And, you know, so it's going to be successful. It's just a matter of how fast people buy into the program. And I first talked with Tripp Wheeler and then Clint Elkins out at Knoxville this year, and they kind of pitched what they were doing a little bit at one of the get-together meetings we had with all the promoters back there. And it really made sense to me. So I went and cornered them after the meeting was over, and we sat and talked for better part of an hour. And then from that point forward, we talked or emailed each other a couple times a week as we just slowly put everything together. You know, what it's going to do, it's going to really bring a lot of awareness of short track racing back to corporate America. And, you know, NASCAR is just a phenomenal machine that they've built over the last 25 years. It's really, really exploded. And I think that corporate America's got so caught up in the luster of NASCAR, and obviously it's getting very, very expensive to be involved with NASCAR and stuff like that, to where for a fraction of the money you can be involved with, you know, the entire country on the short track level. And that's kind of what Humpy Wheeler is putting together is, you know, a guy like Steve Beitler. I'm not going to get past the gatekeeper at Lowe's or Home Depot or any of those big box stores. And the big box stores, they don't have time to pick the phone up and find out who's running the show at Skagit Speedway or, you know, Silver Dollar Speedway in California. So, you know, Speedway Benefits with Humpy and the crew back there, what that's going to do, they're going to do all the legwork, and they're getting the tracks signed up and getting all the information from the tracks, and they put together a proposal, and they go to the company and say, look, you want your, you know, marketing and then branding and products in, you know, 200 to 500 tracks across the United States, hitting every little corner of all the grassroots racing. Here it is, served up on a platter. All I can do is sign here, and we'll take care of the rest. And it really makes it pretty simple for big companies that don't have time to deal with a bunch of smaller entities, and it makes it good for the small entities being us short trackers because we don't speak the language and have the connections to get into the big corporate people.
You had some success yourself 7 years traveling with the World of Outlaws, and of course that meant coming here through the great state of Pennsylvania. What are some of your fondest memories of racing here against the Pennsylvania Posse?
Well, just the fans. I mean, the races are tough back there because you know better than the person you race against. And the fact they've got so many good racers, if you have one or two good racers on the track, they kind of dominate and that's it. But when you got so many as they do in central Pennsylvania, you know, it pushes everybody to be better racers. So the teams themselves, they've excelled, as it's obvious, because they go in and educate the Outlaws on a regular basis when they come into town. But, you know, the biggest thing back there is the fans. And it's a beautiful area. You know, up through the Poconos, and that, I mean, Pennsylvania, that area, there's really a beautiful area to drive around in. And, you know, the fans back there are just so loyal to their sport. And when we got back there, you know, I was from the state of Washington. You can't hardly get much farther away, but gosh, they just embraced me, and I made a lot of friends. I still get, you know, Christmas cards. A guy named Kurt Mayhew, he sends me a Christmas card every year still from Pennsylvania. And, you know, it's so awesome to still have the friends that I have back there. And, you know, Bill Woodside, he's hanging out back in that area now. And that's probably the best memory I have of you know, Pennsylvania racing was the fans, and they're very, very loyal. They're home people, but they're also very respectful and appreciative when an out-of-towner comes into town and wants to race at their facility. And, you know, first time I ever went to Williams Grove Speedway, you know, I'd always read about it and heard about it, and walked in there, got in earlier that day and sat in the grandstands. I just like, oh my God, this place is big. And went out that night and, you know, qualified halfway decent and still not knowing what I was really doing there. It's my second year with the Outlaws. I didn't make it back to PA the first year. And put it in the feature the first night there. It's like, holy cow, man, this is really cool. And, you know, that's how I met Bruce Ellis. He came down and said, you know, it's not every day a guy for the first time rolls in here, never seen the track before, makes the feature at an Outlaw show. And so Bruce wrote a real nice article about me and traveling on the World Outlaws, and was in Open Wheel magazine. And, you know, I formed a friendship with Bruce, and, you know, I still get to see him a couple times a year, you know, back at the Knoxville Nationals. I usually run into him every year and get to visit with him a little bit. And you know, if I had lived anywhere in the country, would be in the sprint cars, you know, obviously be back in Pennsylvania, because that's, you know, that's definitely the sprint car region of the world back there.
But you also were out at another sprint car capital world, as they like to refer to themselves, Knoxville, and you spent 3 years there. What was it like running against Knoxville?
Knoxville is just an awesome area. The town's the same size of the town I grew up in out here, and, you know, I located there, and we raced three or four nights a week out of that area, and I really like the Knoxville area. The track's really a lot of fun to race on. You know, Capitani and I got to be good friends. He took good care of us. And, you know, I work close with a lot of the promoters. You know, Justin Lowe back there at Williams Grove is a good friend of mine. And you know, out at Knoxville, Brian Stickle and those guys, I work with them. And it's nice to have that kind of fraternity to where you can call on these promoters and bounce ideas off them. We run into each other at the conferences and stuff. And, you know, we always kind of hang out. It's kind of like the old college fraternity, you know, and you just sort of hang out together and, you know, BS and talk about good things that's happened and bad things. But, you know, the more than anything, you're doing your networking. And, you know, I've learned a lot by hanging around, just talking to, you know, all the guys back there. And you know, it's a good bunch of guys, that's for sure.
And also, Steve, before we let you go here, and we do appreciate your time, I want to get your thoughts on your reaction to hearing that Steve Kinzer is going to try to go after his 21st and final World Outlaws Sprint Car Championship.
You know, I got so much respect for Steve Kinzer. Obviously, the first day he came out to Skagit Speedway in 1978, you know, he was driving for Carl and the old Denny Mitchell chassis, and he biked her up and turned her over a little bit when he was out here the first time. But, you know, the guy, growing up, you always want to emulate him because he's the best there is. And when I finally got to go out and actually race on the World Outlaw Tour, I mean, I'd run with the Outlaws off and on the West Coast before I took off with them in 89. But, you know, about halfway through the season, I guess he realized I was going to stay out there for a while. And, you know, Carl kind of started helping me a little bit. And even Steve would come by once in a while and he'd tell me stuff. And then, you know, he'd come by one day and he said, hey, if you ever need a shop to work out of, man, you're in the area, just come down by my shop. And I just thought that was so cool. Here's at that time, he was I don't know, a 10-time champion or whatever he was at that time, but he was the big dog, and you know, I was just the new guy on the block, and he treated me with respect, and he was very nice to me, and you know, so over the years, I mean, I've just always really respected what he's done for this sport, and you know, it's like every good thing, there's a time when it has to end, and you know, right now Steve Kinzer's in his twilight years as being a racer, and I mean, I know him good enough that he's not done. This isn't his last year. That guy's going to race, you know, he's still going to race more than just this year, but I mean, this will be his last year running the World Outlaw deal, and I'm really excited for him, because he's going to have to get a semi-truck and trailer for Dana to sell stuff out of. He's going to sell so much souvenirs this year, because everybody's going to want something from Steve Kinzer, because there's never going to be, in our lifetime, there'll never be another sprint car racer that'll come through and dominate and win and do what Steve Kinzer's done for the sport.
You're absolutely correct, and I had a chance to sit down and do an interview with his dad this summer when I was out in Indianapolis, and just what a super nice family, and I agree, they're going to need a semi-tractor trailer for the souvenirs for the upcoming season. Steve, before we go, Skagit outside the Dirt Cup, what are some of the bigger events the fans can expect to see for the upcoming season?
Well, you know, we've got a traveling series up where we started last year. This can expand to both tracks now, called the Summer Thunder Sprint Series. It's a 360-level series that runs, we had, you know, up around 45 cars at a few events last year. This year we'll grow that. And then we have our Summer Nationals, which is a big 360 deal we have every year. We get 50, 60 cars at that. And then we have the World Outlaws will be up here in Labor Day weekend toward the end of the year. And we started a modified class last year, so we're going to build a larger modified race this year out here this year and just kind of get that kicked off. So, you know, also the other thing we're pretty well known for up in the Northwest here is our fireworks shows. You know, I'm kind of a pyro on the side, I guess. I don't know. I like blowing stuff up. And we put on a heck of a fireworks show. I mean, it's just unbelievable, people. We put about 10,000 people in there when we do our fireworks shows. It's, you know, I pull out all the stops. It's not your normal fireworks show, and you better be ready for something pretty amazing if you come watch one. And that's what makes it fun for me. It gives me something to do besides just the racing deal. And it brings a lot of new fans in, and, you know, people are screaming and yelling and having a good time. And somebody asked me one time, a reporter asked me, says, you know, what's the funnest thing about going to the races or being at your racetrack? And, you know, they're saying, you know, is it the racing and all this? And it's like, no, I mean, I've seen 1,000 races in my lifetime, and, you know, I still enjoy a good race, and I really like seeing a new guy win. But for me, the funnest thing about promoting a racetrack is when I stand up there and I look out in the crowd and I see moms and dads and grandparents and grandkids, brothers and sisters out there having fun and betting and elbowing each other. And, you know, it's just families doing something fun together and knowing that I had a little part of bringing these families together for a fun evening out. So that's really, that's what I do this for, is just we put a lot back in our community. And, you know, if you want your community to support you, you better be supporting your community. And we're involved in over 100 different youth school and nonprofit organizations in our area up here. And it's just so doggone much fun that, you know, you get a racer or a fan once in a while that's unhappy about something, you just got to deal with it. But when you see all those people having fun, that's what makes it worth it.
Well, Steve, we want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us here on the Sprint Car Show. All the best of luck to you as the new promoters of Gray Harbor, and continued success with Skagit Speedway.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate what you do for racing back in your area, too. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thanks very much. Steve Beitler joining us here on the Sprint Car Show. We will take a break and be back with more right after this. Just in time for spring, motorsports publisher Coastal 181 will deliver another great open-wheel book titled The People's Champ, A Racing Life. This autobiography of USAC Triple Crown champion Dave Darlin looks at his racing career from quarter midgets to sprint cars. The People's Champ is sure to be a hit with open-wheel fans about one of the sport's true class acts. To learn more, visit Coastal181.com or call them toll-free at 877-907-8181. Coastal 181, reading for racers. Welcome back to the Sprint Car Show. Again, special thanks to our guests Bob Miller and Steve Beitler for joining us here on the first podcast of the 2014 season. We have a lot of great things planned for the show, including some special live on-location broadcasts throughout the year, and we'll tell you about that in the days and weeks ahead. Taking a look at some of the news and notes from around the world of sprint car racing, Donnie Schatz and Craig Kinzer picking up wins in Australia recently, and Luke Dillon leads the World Series of Sprint Car point standings by 23 points over Steve Lyons through round 6 of the World Series of Sprint Cars action. Both Dillon and Lyons, two of the hottest drivers in the circuit right now in Australia. Jack Hodenschild and Destiny Motorsports have announced they're going to go after the championship for the All-Stars in the upcoming season, and that season gets underway in Florida on February the 6th. Speaking of the month of February, February 1st is the deadline to renew your seats at the Port Royal Speedway. Something new this year at Port Royal, they will have no smoking allowed in the main grandstand. They'll have a practice and tunes session coming up on March the 8th, and the season opener for the 410s on March the 15th. And speaking of Central Pennsylvania, the recently retired sprint car great Fred Raymer will be promoting the June 29th Pennsylvania Sprint Car Speed Week date, that coming at the Path Valley Speedway. That should be a great night of racing there with Fast Freddy as the promoter. And the Unite Racing Company will be opening up their 67th season. That comes on April the 11th at the Carolina Speedway in Gastonia, North Carolina. The Sprint Car Show has been brought to you by Coastal 181. Coastal 181, reading for racers, and by Penske Racing Shocks, the competitive advantage of champions, and by the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum, located outside of Turn 2 at the famed Knoxville Raceway. Thanks for listening, everybody. We invite you to join us again next Tuesday, the 14th of January, for another edition of the Sprint Car Show right here on the DirtTrackChannel.com. I'm your host, Sean Wood.
This has been a presentation of the Dirt Track Channel.